Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What you drinking?
I'm drinking all day IPA.
Nice. Not an IPA guy myself.
Yeah. Well, I am.
A little thick for my liking.
Well, so it's session. This is a session IPA, which is, means it's a little less alcohol, but oh, like see. Still more than regular beer.
Yeah. I always feel like. Like a little too drunk, and I just ate like a loaf of bread after like three of those, you know?
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, IPA, it's like a dad beer. You drink one or two. I couldn't sit and drink a six pack of this shit.
There's a lot of dads in the world who are light beer drinkers, my friend.
I'm not ready for that.
A lot of dads who are cranking Mill Lights.
I've not gone that far, dude. This is like my light beer is a session IPA, which has like, so it's like 5.5% alcohol instead of like 7. It's 4.7%.
A light beer for me has become Jameson instead of single malt. That's becoming for me.
Yeah, that's
you know what I like about tonight, Brad?
What's that?
Is that we just interviewed Brian Keeneland from the Bouncing Souls and are doing intros and all that while the first presidential debate is happening.
Yeah. We're not watching.
I would rather box my own fucking balls than watch those two go at it. Goodness gracious. It's like it's been pre-written. Like, why are we even doing this shit? Everybody knows, like, what? There's undecided vote. Like, get the fuck out of here. This is such theater.
It's not undecided votes. It's like, well, yeah. But just, I haven't been able to watch debates even before they were, you know, had such fucking horrible people in them. Because, and I don't include Biden as a horrible person. I think he's probably a really authentically great guy. But he's just another politician. He's not going to get up there and say anything.
Oh, no.
You know, they never do, you know? I mean, the reason I've said this before, and I probably said it on this podcast, but like years ago, I mean, like well before the Obama years, it was probably during one of the like, I think it was during like one of the W debates. And I thought to myself, I said, someday some fucking guy is going to get up here and he's going to talk like a human being and people are going to go nuts. And unfortunately, that guy was Donald Trump. He talked like a fucking asshole, but he talked like a real person instead of like talking like, you know, because every single politician, whether you love them or hate them, they never give you a fucking answer. They, you know, they just talk this politico speak, you know, you ask a question and they change it or they like, and I just thought like someday someone's going to get up and talk like a human being and people are going to love them and like, I didn't know it was going to be the devil.
I mean, I think you're right in a lot of ways. Obviously, people were sick of like standard vanilla political structure where a lot of stuff gets said and nothing's getting done. But if you want to tell me that thing, I don't know anybody who fucking talks like that. You crazy?
You're
like,
right.
I don't know
you're
anybody
right.
who thinks like
you're
that,
right.
talks
Maybe
like
I
that.
Maybe I should say he just didn't talk like a politician.
He didn't talk like a politician, sure. But he didn't talk like a fucking person who knows what's happening in the world.
You're right.
That's
anybody,
a fucking fact.
You're right. Yeah. Anybody like that in our world would have gotten beat down.
Oh, just fucking within seconds. You know what I want to see one of them tell me? This is what I want to see. I want to see one of them tell me what the public bus schedule was like in the town they grew up.
Yeah.
I want one of them to tell me, how do you make a box of fucking Kraft macaroni and cheese? What's your style? Use a lot of butter, a lot of milk, none at all? You know? Like these... That's what you could fucking tell me to tell me that you're actually like a real human right. being in this world.
Right.
Like neither of them are going to say that.
You're right.
That's where
no,
I'm
at. No, it's true. I have no interest in watching it. It'll just depress me. And
no, my metaphor was 100%. I would literally rather punch my own balls right now than watch that thing. I would. Just sock them.
And I do want to say, like, not to dwell on this, but like, I do think that, you know, I think Joe Biden's a genuinely nice guy whose heart is in the right place. And I think well, whatever, it doesn't really matter because anything's better than Trump. But like,
I mean, at this point, here's where I wonder, like, sure, he comes off like that. I have no fucking idea, but I do think, to get to that level in politics, to be vice president that long, to be these things that long, these people know shit, see shit, do shit that I am highly incapable of.
Oh, well,
you know what
absolutely.
I mean? Like just being a career politician, getting to that stage, the kinds of, you know, dicks you've had to suck and vulvas you've had to lick to get to that point, and the people who are over your head and under your head and how many people you're answering to on a regular basis. Like, I don't think they're human. I don't think they're human in the way like Mick Jagger's not human anymore because right. how could he be?
Right.
Because his reality's been so far from fucking any reality for so long. So
since he was 18 years old, we walked into a room, every girl wanted to fuck him. Like, how could you possibly maintain
nothing's
sort of
normal like- anymore? Yeah. Yeah. It's like that John Mulaney has a stand-up bit about it where he's like, you know what Mick Jagger never says anymore? Does anyone know where I could find a laptop charger? You know, like the dumb fucking things that normal people have to say that people like that don't have to say anymore, you know? So I know, yeah, sure, Joe Biden's from fucking Scranton. You know, I know some cool salt-of-the-earth people from Scranton. Like, I don't know if he's still living the Scranton experience. It's where... We're just voting for, you know, who the fuck knows, man? Who knows if these are genuine things, genuine people? You know, it's just impossible. We just got to make decisions. Basically, I'm in a purely selfish business now, you know? Like, I don't care what you fucking are, what you say. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing for me? What are you doing for my life? What are you doing for my family's life? What are you doing for my friends? I don't give a shit how you package it anymore. I don't care about your suit. Your speech, none of that shit. I care about your policy, and that's it. Because the rest of it is just fucking dog shit, no?
Word up. Let's just cap this and say, as cliche as it sounds, get the fuck out there and vote. Even if you're going to vote for that fucking orange piece of shit, just fucking make your voice heard.
And take it from me, a guy who voted for Ralph Nader twice.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't do it. Just don't do it this time. Yeah, don't do it this time.
This
next time we'll make it.
You know what? It is true that every vote counts because even though we have a fucked up system where you can live in a place like New York and think, "Wow, we're gonna go Democratic." The truth is like we need to overwhelmingly have the majority vote, regardless of where the Electoral College comes out as. It needs to be overwhelming that everybody fucking wants a change.
Yeah.
So vote wherever the fuck you are. Vote!
Wow.
All right.
I agree with that.
Fuck that shit.
Fuck all that. We didn't talk about any politics.
Nope. That was as far. That's all you're going to get in this episode.
That's it.
We talked about cool old school shit with Brian.
One of the great storytellers and spinners of yarn I've ever been around and seen. Now I know I had to do the same thing when we had Pete Steinkopf on the show because like, you know, these guys are like the royalty to me. You know, he talks about this time. He's like, oh, you know, in the 90s, when we were doing this. I was one of the little kids at their shows, you know. I was sneaking to New Brunswick to go to these house shows and to like the place that they decided to live and immerse themselves is where I decided to spend my Saturdays and Sundays, you know. And so I love just that trickle down of like, you know, the people who do something. And a lot of these characters he's talking about, he's talking about, you know, Pedro, who used to do spoken words at all their shows. And I'm like, some 14-year-old kid from out by where they're from, listening to this like militant gay Puerto Rican skinhead, you know, like rap at these shows. And I'm like, whoa, this exists. It like just opened up all these worlds. And I know that we're old and we're disconnected from it, but I hope that these things are still happening and the pioneers are still creating these places and the kids are being genuinely influenced
by it. It's happening.
And it
you just don't know about it, old man.
Carries on the tradition. I know. I don't have Twitch. I know. I got to be on Twitch.
It's out there.
To get it. But let's get into this one with Brian. It was fun.
All right.
Hello.
Yeah, hey, Benny, what's up?
These are the mellifluous tones of my voice. Hello. Mellifluous. Remember that bit they used to do on, I think it was SNL, where they said SAT words said by James Earl Jones?
Oh, yeah.
I think that was one of them. I think that's where I learned that word, because it was like...
Great work.
Mellifluous.
What does it mean?
No idea. in excess? Something like that? I mean, that would seem right. I don't hear it often in context. Do you?
I haven't seen that skit, and now I'm definitely going to go watch it.
Mellifluous.
Yeah, super funny. Mellifluously. Having a pleasant and fluid sound. Right. So I used it right. The mellifluous tones of my voice. This is perfect.
Let's
the headmaster read a rather lengthy passage from Stephen Vincent Bennett's The Daniel... Wait, what? In an engaging, mellifluous voice. I'd say you have a mellifluous voice, Brian.
Oh, you think so? I'll try to keep it mellifluous.
You know what you got? You have an accent that very few people know what it is.
Interesting.
But, like, once you start hanging around with the Souls crew... You guys got like a rap. It's like all your own, you know?
Oh, definitely. Definitely yeah. We do.
That's and a fact. I was even given some insight into one of your group texts today, talking to Kate Hiltz about you. And I like how it kind of even carries over into your group text.
Definitely. We all, I can't speak for everybody. I know I probably do it the most, but I like to chop my words. I like to cut words off, shorten them, if you will.
Yeah.
Like keeping it decent.
We're like much a preach.
Oh, much a preach for sure. Keep it profesh.
Profesh. You know? So who invented this rap? Was it you? Because I'll hear certain people talking, you know, like if you used to hang out with Dave Franklin, he would say this stuff.
Exactly.
You know, so who invented this?
Right. Dave Franklin, I would say, might be the godfather of it.
Okay.
Although it's in a parallel universe, before we even knew him in high school, in our first band, we would take Sigs and Sods breaks. we definitely fucked with... Some word chopping in high school too. So I think we've always liked to just fuck with words.
What was your guys' high school band?
The like prehistoric versions of our high school band, like our first and second formations. Brad Karma and the Absent Minded Fruit Bats, for example, took Sigs and Sods breaks. I like your mom was written in that era, actually. That was pre-Bouncing Souls.
Just okay.
Kid shit, you know?
Yeah.
So it's authentically high school or earlier?
Mm-hmm. And back to Dave Franklin. Yeah, he worked construction, but he was and some of the buds threw that around. I think it may have sort of... began almost as an imitation.
Right.
Possibly, but that's just speculation. But it's how we definitely, how we all talked with, along with Dave. So it developed between us and Dave.
I love it that he's the godfather of that.
He's some kind of godfather of chopped words, I guess.
Yeah, I would say that.
He's an OG of it, of the first circle of word choppers.
That's a fact. That's a fact. Now, what is it with you? You, Greg, and Pete all went to the same high school, right?
Correct.
Now, like, did you guys know each other growing up, like Little League style? Or you kind of like met as like punks in high school? How did it come together, you guys coming together?
It was a small town, so we did know each other Little League style, although it wasn't Little League baseball. It was more like township recreation soccer, like little kids soccer. And then Pete and I, like I knew Greg from sports a little bit, knew who he was, but then he went to a different school.
Okay.
Like in the little kid, like grade school years. So we just kind of all knew each other just because it was a small enough town. And Pete and I were in rival BMX gangs.
okay.
True story. So gangs is a strong word here.
Sure. In the gangs of Basti Ridge.
Yeah. Just picture the like, where's my $2 kid? That was pretty much.
Yeah.
From Better Off Dead, that was kind of us. Like,
sure.
Just kind of grubby. Building jumps and like, you know, whatever, building higher jumps. And, you know, you couldn't take this jump. You're a pussy. Like your bike sucks. That kind of shit. Just shit talking, different kind of little cliques that didn't really know each other well. So then the shit talking kind of was there.
Yeah.
That hence the rivalry of sorts. And then fast forward.
Who was the better BMX crew? Like who were you or Pete a better rider?
I think Pete was a faster racer, but I think I got more rad. That's just
okay.
You know, I would just a little bit more reckless and more likely to try some stupid shit.
Sure.
Off a ramp, and that's how I fucking destroyed my knee, of course, too. So
right.
Slow and steady wins the race, guys. Just don't be the jackass.
I wish someone told me that a long time ago.
Exactly, dude. Just, my mom did, but I didn't listen. She's like, you'll pay for it later. And I'm paying for it now.
I know. It's like how many punk rockers in their 40s are like, listen, I can't jump anymore. I got shin splints, you know? Like, I jump too much in flat fucking vans that have no support. And
That's it.
That's exactly it, dude. Like, I hope someone got the video or the picture because that's it. Because it's like 3 feet, 4 feet in the air, like all at all times on stage is just over.
Like, maybe it's not about telling the kids, like, don't jump, because, you know, the kids are going to jump. But maybe we got to start giving them proper footwear, you know?
Well, you know, you would I tell you what, if it was me now, I probably wouldn't be so excited about Vans. But, you know, in the 80s, having Vans, that was a statement. Like,
right.
Maybe two... three people in Basking Ridge had vans that like were in the know, you know, and that you were cool.
And where is the closest shop to Basking Ridge, like to get skate shit and BMX shit? I mean, there was nothing really close, right? Was it?
Yeah, ordered shit out of like BMX Plus.
Right.
Out of the back of BMX Plus. So like wherever the ads were, like that's where we got our skate stuff too. Like that's where we were so excited about, you know, whatever. Powell Bones 3's coming out like and just being like, oh. And you don't have any fucking income, but you just wanted, and you just wanted those wheels, or you wanted like. For me, I was obsessed with Maxi Cross cranks. They were like 3-piece cranks that I couldn't afford for my BMX bike. And Pete had Redline Flight cranks. That was like the freshest cranks you could get.
Yeah,
like,
dope ones. Yeah.
What are cranks?
It was all about cranks?
What are cranks?
What are cranks?
They're you crank your bike with them. They come out of the bottom. Of your, the like bearing cup of your frame. There's cranks. The pedals are attached to them, so you move your legs, and the cranks turn the chain wheel, which turns the chain, which moves the bike forward.
Okay,
cranks. You know, there was 1-piece cranks.
You mean,
there was 3-piece cranks?
Like the gears?
Like the gears?
Yeah.
Oh,
bearings.
Oh. All right.
I mean, if you were like really into it, you're messing with the gearing of your bike too. It was higher or lower gearing for like the snap off the starting gate and all that, like for racing. And, you know, that was like, it got a little nerdy, I guess. So we loved our bikes. We take them apart, clean everything.
So how did you two reconcile from rival BMX gangs to starting to play music together?
In high school, there was a pretty small, very tiny percentage of people that were into punk. I mean,
yeah.
There was like a handful. So we were quickly a tight-knit little group, you know? That's how we all kind of converged around going to shows and just getting into music, getting into all the bands and stuff. And, you know, back then, our high school was really pretty fucking cool. Like, there was, it sounds so gross to talk about cigarettes to me now, but like, we actually had a smoking lounge. There was an actual, like, wow. A patio. We called it smoke lounge. I'm sure it wasn't the intention of building the patio, but everybody, like, smoked butts out there. You know, it was like the burnout, the metalhead kids, and like the punks. And then, like, a couple of teachers that were like, a little more dirt ass. And so we actually all bonded, you know what I mean? So we were all knew each other and like, yo, grab them smoke. Like from the Maiden Hash kid, you know,
yeah,
cause we all loved Iron Maiden and you know what I mean? It kind of crossed over Metallica back then cause you could skate to it. Anything that was fast and aggressive. I liked, so I liked those metal bands and metalheads. You know what I mean? Again, it was a small town, kind of knew each other anyway and knew who each other were, and everybody was pretty cool. So we started, you know, going to shows together, me, Pete, and Greg back then, and just, you know, hanging out after school every day. They'd like, Greg would come over and skate my ramps, Pete would come over, and we would jam. And then kind of we just became three totally inseparable people.
That's awesome. Where were you guys going to shows from there? Were you heading into the city or New Brunswick? Like, where were you seeing most of it?
Most of the shows we went to were at City Gardens in Trenton. Oh,
gotcha. At that time, sure.
It was a great club. And then we would go to the city, too.
Who had the cool parents who would bring you guys down to Trenton?
We were driving. Somebody had a car.
Okay, somebody was driving by then.
Nobody's parents was driving us. Like, yeah. That's like, so sketchy, too. Like, so sketch. Like, you hoped your radio was still in your car when you came out after the show.
Yeah.
It was never a dull moment there. I mean, people, you could get jumped. You could just come outside and just get jumped, or your car get fucked up. And then there was like this, there was like a South Jersey skinhead scene. And some of those guys were pretty gnarly. There was also a little bit of, there was just some pretty dangerous characters there, and there was always a fight, and then the fight would converge and then all file outside and do a big ass brawl. Like, there's some pretty crazy shit that went down, and it was all very exciting for us. We were going to every show, and back then, like, everything kind of under the banner of punk for us, you know, would be like, one week it would be the Cramps, which, by the way, was one of the greatest shows I saw back then. The most exciting live shows back then were probably the Cramps and Fishbone.
Ooh, nice.
And this is like a guilty pleasure, or it's not even that, but in 1988, somewhere around then, the Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of came into the into the universe of punk rock, punk rockers, and they were playing City Gardens, and seeing those guys play was mind blowing.
Yeah,
they put on a fucking show back then. Like,
no, I saw those guys probably in '88, and it was, I think it was actually with Fishbone, and it was a fucking,
they were both
sick,
like,
shows.
They would tour together. Yeah,
yeah.
And those guys exactly. Are kind of punk, even though they didn't sound punk, you know.
They were just, the aggression kind of was there, and the attitude, and like, dude, just watching Flea play bass blew my brain, like, just really blew my brains out. I was just like, dude, upside down, just beating the shit out of his bass. Like,
yeah,
that was a big influence on me, just live show wise. Like, same with Fishbone. Yeah. We like admired them and kind of tried to emulate them. And luckily we kind of checked ourselves pretty early on, and we were like, we should stop. and pretend we never did it. You know, of course we recorded some pretty like awkward attempts at that stuff. And back then, we also loved reggae a lot. I mean, we saw Toots and the Maytals there and
sure.
Yellow Man. We were big into Yellow Man and Toots and the Maytals, to name a few. And both of them we would see in high school too. And we would try to incorporate that into songs. And then there was CB's. I was going to CB's matinees in high school, and also that just getting exposed to that whole scene and discovering a lot of great bands, New York hardcore bands, and we would bring that into the songwriting too. So the songs were just, you know, kids learning how to play together, and then like, let's just go into a reggae part and then a hardcore part. And then like, it was just like pretty scattered and, you know, awkward, but right. We were so excited just to play. I mean, it's just the greatest feeling playing together with people, you know? So
yeah, it takes wisdom to realize that just because you can play something doesn't mean you should.
And right.
That takes some years to get.
You know what happened is like, we started getting right around the time we started playing in New York, which is also in the first couple of years, we started getting billed, like put on all these bills that were like, thank God it's Funk Day or like,
okay,
funk this and whatever, like Psychofunkapus and the funky this, that. And it was all like, there was a whole thing that happened where there was a lot of like bad, like white guy funk. It yeah. really, I mean, didn't matter if the bass player was amazing or if the, you know, they could play well. It's just, it's an abomination. Like, it's a terrible thing. It's just one of those bad things. Sorry, like white reggae too for me. Like they're bad things. Like,
yeah.
And life is too short.
I'm with you. Me, it's strange.
For me to listen to that stuff. Like when it comes on, I'm like, mm-mm. Like put on Trojan Records and like, let's, or like King Tubby. I can listen to that for days on end. Like,
yeah.
Good. A real Jamaican dub and reggae like is one of the greatest things, but like I can't fuck with white funk and white reggae. You know, there's some really good guys too. I don't want to.
Oh, yeah. It's not about talent. It's just about, yeah, I'm with you. There's something about, you could be the greatest band in the world and it feels different. I don't know why.
And like, you know what?
Life's too short. There's so much damn good reggae out there. Right. You dig into like the past and open these wormholes of different types of reggae and artists you never heard of before. You might as well just go in reverse, I think, with reggae, you know?
I feel that way. That's where I live. I mean, I make a couple exceptions to the rule, like the Slackers and Hepcat, and there may be a couple other guys out of that New York scene, and Hepcat out of the West Coast, like, to name a couple of more current bands that like did it justice, you know?
And maybe that's the more honest interpretation for white people to go with it, is to make it kind of punk, make it a little, you know, to give it that spin, you know, and maybe that's the way to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like, you know, it's kind of like, maybe it's just my attitude. I'll be the first to admit that I'm wrong at a lot of shit, but that's my preference, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't gotten bored of digging deeper into the entire catalog of Trojan Records. Like that, I haven't like been like, oh, that's it. I'm going to go listen to some current bands now.
Sure.
And do it. Even if they're good, I'm not there. Like I'm still probably for the rest of my life, I'm just going to enjoy a lot of amazing Jamaican reggae.
Yeah. Any discoveries the last couple years that people should dig into?
It's like, I just kind of named my favorites. I mean, okay. If you have Spotify and you just say like, play King Tubby, just let it go.
Yeah.
You're right. Going to find your own favorite stuff. And then you're going to like kind of highlight those songs and then those artists and then go down those roads. And it's the same thing with Trojan, and you can follow Trojan Records on Instagram, and they'll do like Artist of the Week, and like there's so much Toots and the Maytals stuff that there was actually, I heard songs I hadn't heard, which is kind of, yeah, after his untimely death, they made him the Artist of the Week like 2 weeks in a row, and I was just playing that and just still discovering stuff. Like there's still stuff to discover.
That's awesome. Well, going back a little, like back to New Brunswick days, because I asked how you got down to Trenton because one of the first times I really got in a lot of trouble was getting dropped off at your old house in New Brunswick for a show, which kind of like fucked me up for a couple years. Cause like after I got dropped off at that show and was begrudgingly let out of the car in that neighborhood, I had a hard time getting to that part of New Brunswick again for a few years. You know, I had to start taking strange ways on trains and stuff to even get to New Brunswick because I couldn't convince an adult to take me there anymore. And I know none of you guys went to Rutgers, right?
Nope.
Which I love because I'm one of the few people, too, that did about a decade in New Brunswick with no Rutgers. Since you were going to New York so much and City Gardens, what was your connection to the New Brunswick scene that made you guys want to base there and play music there?
Well, we couldn't wait to get out of Baskin Ridge as soon as we could, basically.
Sure.
After graduation, and we wanted to all move in together and do the band. And I think New York would have been the ideal spot, but New Brunswick was like closer and more affordable. And just enough, like we needed like a more urban setting, or so we thought, and a place where music happened, and there was venues and bands, and all this stuff that was kind of in our, turned out to be a lot of it in our imagination.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I guess coming from Baskin Ridge, which was very rural at the time that we grew up there, it was sure. Trees and trails and everything. We just wanted more city like environment. That's at least speaking for myself. You know, skating all night because there's streetlights and good curbs and like parking decks, and it didn't take much, you know, like going to the center. Right.
Yeah, when you're coming from that place, I mean, it's funny you say it because I had such a similar experience. You know, New Brunswick was like a mecca to me, and now when I look in hindsight, it's a small place with not that much going on. But it
it was like the big city, way. I mean, we knew it wasn't New York or anything, but we, you know what I mean? Like, we didn't need much. We needed like restaurants that were open late, lights that were on, like people, young people, parties, shows, et cetera, and a place to start the band, you know. And when we got there, I mean, this is like, we've told this story 1,000 times, so I don't really want to beat a dead horse, but we got there and there just kind of wasn't much of that going on. And there was like, you know, the Core Tavern had punk bands, but it was 21 and over, and we were teenagers. We couldn't even get in there nor much less get a gig. We got booked one gig through a sort of one of our new friends there. He was a skinhead and he was friends with The Press, who was an oi band. And, I was a skinhead, like our crew, a lot of the kids were skinheads, and sidebar, anti-racist skinheads.
Yes.
It sucks that when you say the word skinhead that everyone just thinks of the bonehead, white power, fucking scumbag racists. Yeah. But we were the opposite. Yes. We were completely the opposite. I like to call it my checkered past, because very into the two-tone.
Well done.
Very much like all the whole, like, you know, these like white boys that wanted to be black and wanted to immerse ourselves in black culture. It was kind of, it's embarrassing to tell that story, but like, we were just like, it's the opposite of a racist. We were like,
yes,
yeah, man, hey man, like, right, you too, bro, we're down, you know, like, no. And we like walked around with, you know, sharp flyers, which was skinheads against racial prejudice. And we were like we were like the only white people in a completely black neighborhood. Yeah. And here we are, boots and braces, and this is right about the time where all those fucking white power people were making a big splash in like Morton Downey Jr. and all of the daytime talk shows were having them on.
Motherfucker was on Geraldo and stuff.
Geraldo. Yeah. Remember somebody punched Geraldo, broke his nose or something?
Yeah. Everyone should YouTube. Well, maybe don't give it the streams, right?
But
don't even give it the streams. Yeah.
But yeah, but whatever. So this was right when people went from never having heard of skinheads to hearing about them all the time, and only the white power and racists and Nazis. And there's us, like, boots, braces, for the whole shit, you know, and some punks, some skins, but basically, like, all of that oi English, Anglophile, you know.
Right.
Kids all into that stuff. And just walking around those streets and with our sharp flyers and handing them out, walking right up to people and being like, we're anti-racist.
What was like the local reception to it like?
It's funny, like on Welton Street, which was our first house was 54 Welton. We quickly, because we were so excited and just didn't have any, like, I don't know what it was, the energy that we put out. We were just so like, hey man, you know, like,
yeah.
We made friends. We made friends with our next door neighbors. And then one of the, all right. So this house that we rented, it was funny. It was like Chris, the drummer of Sticks and Stones, who came from Basking Ridge and who is how we got hooked up with the house.
Okay.
We lived there with Pedro, who is a militant Puerto Rican homosexual skinhead.
Yeah, sure is.
Self-proclaimed. So there was Pedro and Chris from Sticks and Stones, and then our band and Ugly Bill. And like, it was like Ugly Bill, Creepy Gary, Mike Irwin, just like a bunch of heads, you know. And then there were skins coming in from DC and Kansas City. So the house just sort of filled up with all these different kind of dudes. Like, and there was black skinheads and a mixed race skinhead named Leo, who was like 7 feet tall. I mean, it was pretty kind of like a intimidating looking bunch too, all together. And so I guess you could say we were probably getting a lot of attention, but the other thing about this house is it had an abandoned above ground pool, shitty, about maybe 8 feet in diameter, four feet deep, 5 feet deep. Who knows? You know, this above ground pool with like just filled with garbage and trash. And we cleaned it out, filled it. We like got some pool shock from somebody we knew in Basking Ridge that had a pool, you know, and we made a nice pool basically for ourselves for that summer. And like we had, as this was happening, we were making friends with our neighbors and their little brothers, a lot of like 10-year-old age kids or so, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, like younger kids were coming over like, can we swim in the pool? And we're like, yeah, man, let's all hang out. You know, like, and so that it turned into the entire summer. There was like, you know, about 8 kids from the block that just hung out at our house, out in the pool, you know, like just hung out all the time. And, you know, they would like wander in because it was like this open door policy, you know, just we didn't care. And there'd be like someone buzzing their head out on the deck. And right. What are you doing, man? And like I was tattooing them, which is, I'm just remembering this shit as I'm telling it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
put my name on me, man. Be God. And like, I'm Pat Lee. Like, I want Pat Lee. And like, I was tattooing these kids and their brothers wanted tattoos and they called me Be Nice because I was nice to everybody.
Be Nice.
Be Nice.
Might have to bring that back in.
I forgot you tattooed like forever.
Ugly Bill and I got into it just out of high school. Like, still in high school, I was tattooing like Greg and Pete and Bill and, you know, all the heads, you know.
Did somebody show you like the basics or what?
The first thing I learned was, as I recall, I think it was watching that X documentary. what's the name of it? Or was it even on Decline? I can't even remember if it was on Decline of the Western Civilization and X was tattooing themselves, or if it was the X documentary. Unknown, what the fuck's the name of it? But anyway, we saw, basically we watched X doing it, doing what we called pin tats. Now the kids call stick and poke, but it was like you take a sewing needle, thread it, and then you spin the tip, you spin thread around the tip, and you get a little ball of thread up close to the tip, and then you dip it in India ink. That the thread soaks up the India ink, and then you just poke a dot. Poke one dot at a time and the ink runs down the tip.
Right.
And you go, and you have a dot. So you just, you go dot by dot by dot by dot, you know?
Wow.
And I was freehanding everything. Just, it was all like, everybody got like oi or skinhead or their name or an ankh right? I couldn't really think of it, you know, a music note. They're all stupid. Like I the biggest one, I most elaborate one I did was on Shao, who wanted a bird with he wanted a bird sitting on a drumstick, smoking a butt with sunglasses. So bad.
So you're basically giving jailhouse tattoos in this like anti-racist skinhead house.
Yeah, that's yeah. That was one of the many things we did at that house. Yeah.
Oh my god, man, I love it.
Skating all night and fucking and just I don't know what and practicing. You know, we had a jam room. We had a basement, so we were writing all our funky jams down there.
Yeah. It's so fun. Well, I mean, kind of on the same topic, I don't know how much you care to get into it, but I know you've been fairly public on social media about it. You've adopted a child, yeah?
I have. I have a beautiful daughter, yeah. Cora. She just turned 10 months.
Whoa.
In the 19th.
So what was that like? Yeah. Well, like, I know so little about it. What was the process like of just making that happen and setting up your life and your house? To allow that,
you know, it's funny. My wife was the perfect person to come along in my life because neither of us we were kind of living parallel lives before we knew each other, and neither of us wanted kids the whole time. We were like, kids, you know. I guess like everyone's that way in their 20s. I kind of feel like, but like I stayed that way. You know, I was just like, I'm having fun. What do you mean? I'm the kid. You know, just living it and her too. She just went, you know, and basically when we met, she's like, I didn't ever want kids until I met you. And then I wanted to do that with you. And then we both were into the idea of adoption, which is also really cool. Like, you know, it's, you need a coalition of the willing, just like starting a band.
Yeah.
You got people that are into the same thing.
Yeah.
And we were into it. And, you know, and then we kind of like dicked around and I think wasted too much time, but in hindsight, we kind of just dicked around and like, you know, enjoyed our lives and
as
dinks, dual income, no kids.
Oh, that's so good.
We were kind of running out the last of that, like, you know, we're going to the lanes again tonight. Right, like we're all hanging out. Like we're having fun down here at the beach. Just shacking up but getting married and having a good time. And then we kind of like, we're like, fuck, we're getting fucking old. We gotta do this shit or get off the pot. And so Nicole is the planner in the family. And she went through every adoption agency in New Jersey. I mean, it's at the beginning of the process. You're trying to narrow down the massive world of possibilities. Mm. I mean, you're like, oh, do we adopt internationally or just domestically? You start just sort of like answering questions for yourself. And my thing was like, there's fucking kids here. Like, you know, like, there's kids like in New Jersey that need families, you know? And so that's what we did, you know? And, it's actually not that all of it, is actually not that daunting, except for it's not cheap.
Oh, okay.
There's that part, but they work with you that way too. I mean, you know what I mean? It's not that even that isn't like a deal breaker. You know, people buy cars and pay them off. You know, you sell shit, you come up with money. I think when you put it out to the universe, you know what I mean? For something this big and important, it just kind of works. It worked for us, you know?
Right.
So that's what we did. We pooled our resources. So that's the paying for it part, but the rest of it is not so daunting, really. The adoption agency that we chose, I imagine all of them, they pretty much hold your hand through the process, the paperwork, and so forth. And it's, you know, there's a home study where they come to your home and you're being vetted, I guess, in a sense, you know.
Yeah,
You know, they want to make sure you're not psychopaths,
right?
Or whatever, hoarders and scumbags.
Cannibals.
So it all went really smoothly. And I think like relative to, I think how long it can take, it went pretty quickly too.
Awesome.
And it's funny. Like you got, it's kind of a mind fuck. Like we got matched with a birth mom, like a woman, a pregnant woman. Women, pregnant women who want to make an adoption plan, choose an agency, go to them. The agency advocates for them and they walk them through the whole thing and they're like, yeah, okay. Like, and then they present them with like, well, here's a bunch of families in our, you know, roster. And so that's one of the things you have to do when you're an expecting family is you have to make like a profile book, which is awkward. It was kind of hard and weird for us, but yeah, at the same time, it's really simple. It's just a scrapbook.
It's like a family, like one sheet.
Yeah. It's like, you know, like one of those like snap. What did we use? But you know what I mean? Like iPhoto books,
right?
Those things you just send away and you get the book in a couple of days. You just pick pictures, you lay out a book, you add blurbs. This is us. He works here and does this. This is our friends. This is our jobs.
Like, right.
Blah, blah. It's kind of weird, you know, but we had a profile book. One expectant birth mother chose us pretty really early on. And we were like, this is great. And you also can signify like we want a boy or a girl or this race, that race, right. No race, any race. And we were just like, first kid, any race, of course, we don't care. Any sex, we don't care, you know?
Right.
So we were matched quickly with a mom who was having a little black boy. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to have a boy. Like, and he's black. That's even fucking cooler. Like, this is the coolest thing ever. Yeah. And then we kind of prepared our home. And then she had the, and this went on, you know, this whole phase was kind of like exciting. And then she had the baby and changed her mind.
Yeah.
We were like, no, but that happens. Like, you got to roll with it.
Yeah. Wow.
And we're just kind of back in the lottery, you know? And then we got another call, not too much further down the road. And it was like a Puerto Rican couple in North Jersey that was expecting a boy. And we were like, cool, time to fucking brush up on our Spanish. Cause we can't be the gringo motherfuckers that can't speak
right,
Spanish.
Sure.
Jerk off white people. So like mentally we just changed channels kind of to that. And they wanted to take your book home for the weekend. And think about it. So we waited through the weekend and we waited through Monday, Tuesday. We're just expecting this phone call, you know? Wow. And your whole life's doing these weird shifts and changes inside. All this kind of weird things are going on. And then about 5 days went by. Just as we were starting to like just give up hope,
yeah.
We're like, all right, I guess that's kind of weird that they didn't like tell us or something, but like, okay. And then we get a phone call and you're like, you know, Nicole answers and it's like the social worker from the agency. And she's like, is dad home? Is he there? Go get him. Like, and like FaceTime call, you know, and they're like, your parents. Wow. And we're like, whoa. And it was Cora, our daughter, like a black girl born in Philly.
Okay.
And we're like, fucking cool. Like, it's just like, How do you even describe like the emotions? Like the universe just gave you a baby human being to like parents of like, yeah. I guess every parent goes through this, natural birth parents and adoptive parents, et cetera. I like to think ours is a little more exciting because, I don't know. It's just been obviously like, and every parent will say this too. It's totally life changing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and it continues to be life changing. You're in the cute phase, dude.
yeah. Dude,
she's beyond cute too. Like she's just, I know. I know. I assume at least one of you guys is parents.
We're both parents.
Yeah, we got four between the two of us. But this could easily get turned into like a mowing the lawn and wiping assholes episode with this. I don't think that's what the people want, Brent.
No. Like, I'll keep it real brief on that. Everybody tells me like, and I know it. Like, the worst is coming. Like, she's just starting to about to walk.
Yeah.
So
right.
10 months is so perfect. It's such a great age.
Yeah,
it's just so. Yeah, it's crazy. And now, based on what you were talking about before, with like, you know, your experience with race in New Brunswick and sort of trying to immerse yourself into the neighborhoods you were in and a different culture. Like, is there something specific like you guys are hoping or trying to do to make it as fluid as possible for both of you, for your daughter and for you guys, to be able to recognize that experience while still recognizing yours? Like, have you talked much about the balance and the things you'll do to connect those worlds?
Yeah. I mean, from this point forward, I mean, it's just all about Cora. And yeah. So I've had everything I could ask for in my life. I'm here to serve now, and I'm here to serve her, those two.
Okay.
And Cora, it's like that's all we think about is her experience. And we've got a lot of work to do, and we don't want to raise her in like a vanilla white people world. Like, we want to surround her with as much diversity. I mean, just diversity. I think it's the best thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we take her places where we are in the minority.
Sure.
You know what I mean? As much as possible, educate us, continue to educate ourselves as much as possible on every angle that we can, so that we can be teachers. But then also, we're going to be the students, I think, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And just be cool. And just be cool. And but we're thinking about that all the time. As a matter of fact, we just recently told our adoption agency to sign us up for one more baby.
Ooh.
And oh, wow. The only stipulation being is that that baby has to be black. We do right. not want.
Well, now you're talking about a sibling, different story. Yeah.
We want a sibling for her, but more specifically a black sibling to even the odds in the household.
Yeah.
And also for her to have someone there to go through all of those experiences and have someone to relate to, you know what I mean?
Sure.
All of it, going to school and going to just all of the experiences, I think, of being black that we can't relate. We can't, you know what I mean? Sure, we can just be there for her and shower her with love and do the very best we can. But we also know that, like, there are certain things that we can't provide directly. And so we're trying to just sort of fill our world with more of that all the time.
That's awesome.
You know?
Well, only one cardinal rule, right? No white reggae in the house.
You better believe it. She's already well versed in all of the reggae, all of the Jamaican stuff I already mentioned.
Good.
But pretty much, not for nothing, but that's almost everything we play.
Reggae is perfect for kids. Actually, both of my kids were born to Bob Marley. Like literally in the hospital room, like born to Bob Marley, because we just wanted the vibe, man, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, can you beat it? I mean, to me, I'm like, some of the stuff I listen to, I'm like, this is as good as you could ever hope for children's music, too.
Like, the best feeling music. It's so lo-fi that it's like easy on the ears.
Three Little Birds. Come on, man.
It's perfect.
All of it, dude. I mean, all of it. All the soul music out there in the world, like Nina Simone and Sam Cooke, all the like Motown stuff, that's what she's getting. That's what she's hearing. She's going to be as well versed in that. And then like I other music that I think is great, sort of children's music too, is like Cat Stevens. Cause it's kind of beautiful. Yeah. Not black, but
Cat Stevens. Certainly not black. No.
That guy's white,
yeah,
but
guy's
whatever.
Pretty white, yeah.
We'll let him slide.
And I hope you play Greg's record from time to time.
Play date?
We've got children's music in the family, too. Greg and Shanti, so he's going to have all that.
Well, Brian, this is the perfect opportunity to segue into a segment we have on this show called Mystery Friend.
Mystery Frat?
Mystery Friend. So I'm going to tell you a story that happened in your life. I would like you to get into the story and tell me the deets. And then you have to guess which one of your friends told me this story. Hence the mystery friend. Okay.
Mystery friend. Okay. Who told you the story?
All right. So
All right.
The story starts in 1995 with the Bouncing Souls opening for Rancid at the Roselands. Apparently, mm-hmm. this is when Rancid was right before Out Come the Wolves. They're on the precipice of being big. And Madonna's at the show trying to sign them to Maverick Records. And I heard that a young, smelly version of you tried fairly aggressively to meet Madonna. Can you tell me what happened there?
It sounds like exactly like me. And I remember, I might have had a couple beers because I don't remember real crisp details about that.
Okay.
I remember standing there, seeing her, talking to Tim and being like, I'm going to go talk to her. And I'm pretty sure that's what I did, but I couldn't tell you what I said, you know?
Okay. All right.
I liked it.
Well, this is a good mystery friend. Well, luckily I have two today. So this one, I guess I'll fill in the blanks because I have some info. Apparently, Madonna raced out of the back of the show and went into like a Mercedes. And you guys were outside and you had just loaded out and you were hanging out by the van. So you saw this play out and you saw the guys from Rancid being summoned to the car. And they were chatting, and I was told that you were living in squats, super gross and gnarly. You had a tank top that was white, that was now gray, and you were pretty rank, like you were smelling pretty bad.
Yes.
And you kind of had a vibe of like, oh, you want to sign punk bands? Like, I'm a fucking punk. Like, what about mine? You know?
And that was probably my vibe.
Yeah, and then apparently some security guard jumped out of nowhere. Like about 10 feet away from Madonna, you tried to kind of duck and dive a little, and he kind of O-lined you out, and then you couldn't get by, and then gave up and go away.
Yes, that's why I can't remember what I said to her, because I never got the chance.
Yeah, never made it. You never made it. Just the stinky version of you. All right, so let's move on to option two then, since this one's a little blurry. I hope this one's not as blurry. And I also hope, as a new father, you're willing to talk about it. So... Uh-oh. You're living in New Brunswick on Hamilton Street, and apparently, you know, wound up with a woman at the Chelsea Hotel. And you had a surprise visitor who popped in and you know, had some fun with the evening. Do you remember this one?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me the story?
Oh,
Or is this off duty since you're a pops now?
It's kind of dark. It's kind of a dark story. I'll give you the like sort of cliff notes. I kind of end up living at the Chelsea Hotel for a few weeks. I think I just sort of disappeared from the New Brunswick world. That was sort of my first steps into living in New York.
Okay.
Was staying at the Chelsea Hotel with that girl. She had been Gigi Allen's girlfriend when he died, I think. Wow. She was a runaway from San Francisco. All of her friends were junkies. So they were coming in and out of her room and just, they were like, we're going down to see the cop. And they would like go and get drugs. And this was my first like seeing these things like China White.
Right.
Doing these in heroin, and I'm like, no interest in that at all. I wanted to smoke some weed, drink beer, you know, hang out with this girl. But her friends, that was my sort of entertainment, I guess. They were coming in and out. It was just kind of lame, honestly. Looking back on it now, it was just like not a lot of good. And the person of note, I suppose, was Dino from the Murder Junkies.
Yeah, that is the particular story I heard.
Yeah, and I do remember him being like, I'm just going to stick this drumstick, and stuck a drumstick up with his ass. He was like on the floor like, you guys don't mind, right? Like, we had the bed, you know? There was like one bed in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
These other heads were just kind of coming in and out, kind of partying. There was sort of always like a party going on in the rest of the room. And I remember that. And I'm like, this whole thing's so fucking crazy and surreal. Like,
yeah.
My first New York, like, days. Like, and you know, I can zoom out a little bit on this and this is when I had become restless with living in New Brunswick, just kind of was over it.
Right.
And at, this is out at the same time the band had become busy enough with touring where we could no longer kind of hold down normal lives, where we couldn't really hold jobs,
right,
and could no longer pay rent in New Brunswick. And so we were just crossing over into being a band who we were like, we had gone across country with Lifetime and this girl, Margie, booked the tour. And we were like, we were on that tour and we were like, Margie, book us another tour, book us another tour. We just want to keep touring. And that's what happened. We went back and like on a quote unquote headlining tour in 93, the Drink Coffee and Destroy tour, 1993. And it was 93 was the pivotal year where we kind of, we had a van and we kind of didn't really have rent, you know? And this is when Kate came into the picture because she ran a futon shop across the street. White Lotus Futon. Kate hired me and we're like, okay, cool. This is a job that we can pay for food with, but we can kind of like come and go, and she'll let us go on tour because Kate's cool. And she was just, we're in a touring band. We got to go on tour. And she kind of like, that wasn't really the policy there, but she was just like, okay. Like, and so we would, thanks to Kate and White Lotus Futon, we were able to push forward into becoming a national touring band, which, you know, Red is punks in a van with nowhere to live who just, but we have a place to be if we have a gig and we have a van. So we have a home. So, and we would come back into New Brunswick after some touring and like make futons. And then we would sleep on the futon, like the displays. There was a front room, like a nice showroom with all these beds made up with fancy organic futons and like, you know, missionary frame and the whatever. And like, they were expensive, like beds.
White Lotus, futon. Nice. Very nice.
Nice stuff. Yeah. And we would literally sleep on the display. And there's all these like windows in the shop and like drunk college kids would like walk by and be like, I think someone's sleeping in there, you know? We'd lay totally still. And so, yeah. And this is during this time, that's when the Chelsea Hotel happened. And that's when I was like, I'm moving to New York. Like, I'm just that. This is my next thing. I'm going to New York. And
yeah, and you did, of course, you did some time in like C Squat, some places like that. No,
yeah, not. I didn't live in C Squat. I lived in Serenity, which is around the corner from C Squat. But yeah, that was the winter of '93. Was a Chelsea Hotel. So '94 summer. As the weather broke, I was just going over there, making some friends and just sleeping where I could. I knew like we had one friend with a room. I'd sleep there sometimes. And then I would sleep. I met some other kids and like was sleeping in the park or following these kids around, drinking with these kids and then just sleeping on a stoop somewhere. Wow. Or like, we're going down to the East River and there's like a baseball diamond and we sleep there. And I'm like, all right, cool. Like I'm sleeping. So I was like just sleeping under like in the rough for.
And were you like you were like all about it? Like were you like, what am I doing? Or were you just like all about it?
No,
like
I was young and I was fucking all about it, yeah. Man. I loved New York City, and it was only a matter of time before I was going to live there. And so I was excited to be there, and just drinking 40s and hanging out and chilling, going to shows, and going back and forth, and the band. Meanwhile, the band was all kind of doing that same thing in their own ways, like just figuring shit out. Mm-hmm. And what we did as a band collectively is we paid for one room in Hoboken, which was about the size of a, you know, maybe 8 feet by 8 feet little room. And we're like, that's Pete's room. It was like $200 a month. And we were like, we can swing that. And there's a basement there. It was a house that Johnny X found and rented for us, but then we rented the one room, and then the whole band therefore felt entitled, like, we can practice here. And so that became another landing pad between tours. And so I was kind of going back and forth between that Hoboken house to the city, and then like taking the train and then going to New Brunswick, making some futons for a couple of days, and then practice Hoboken, then back to the city again. Yeah. And then eventually I met someone who lived in a squat in Serenity and moved in with that person, and then did a lot of work to become, like, quote, an asset to the building,
right.
Prove myself, got voted in, got given my own apartment. And then that was a big, big change.
Wait, explain that to me. That's something I don't know much about. Like, so you get there and is it like a utilitarian style? Like you fix this thing, or you did, like, how do you add to it to get that?
There were work days. So there would be like a flyer in the hallway. And there would be work days, and you'd show up and you would work. Yeah. I got really good at drywall, cause we were bringing a building up the code. There was a lot of work to do. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of talent, people who lived there that were like, who worked for the city and were welders and got girders and like chop saws. And we made stairs, poured concrete stairs with the steel girders and did like real heavy, serious work. And then maybe that was the work one, for a few weeks or you were on some other detail. Or and then there was like a guy who had worked for the city and knew how to, and I can't remember exactly how he did this, but we got electricity by means of this guy going in a manhole. And I was standing watch on one corner, somebody was standing watch on another corner. You were always looking over your shoulder for JCP and L trucks, company. Yeah. You kind of like retrain your priorities always in life around what's going on. And I remember having to kind of break the habit of like looking for things I could burn, because there was a wood burning stove was the only heat source in the apartment. So you'd go out, you'd go to like the bar, but then you were always looking for shit. You could go walking home, looking in the garbage for shit you could burn.
Wow. Yeah.
And you kept a candle in your jacket because there was just not electricity a lot of the time, And then eventually we resolved it really in a really cool way. Like we paid for stoop lights, stoop and hallway lights. And then we built a wall in the basement and like had another breaker, and all the apartments kind of like jumped juice off of that. Yeah, it was we eventually got to that level, and then it went way beyond that. And now it's a complete, I gave up my apartment years ago, but I mean, obviously years and years ago at this point. But now it's a legit place. Like the city gave it to the people who live there.
I know.
Same with C-Squat. They those guys are stoked. So really cool, really cool. Not a lot of shitbag junkies. As you would think, like you might have one or two of those crumbing around. People were dying. Those people were dying though. But right. The people that were that I was kind of focused on were my friends. There were guys in bands, right. That's how I met Sturgeon when he had Choking Victim, and Squirt lived upstairs from me. He was the drummer. Like they were a pretty good band. There was a band called The Dregs. Guy Mike was a friend of mine. Those guys are friends of mine. There was just like at the time in the 90s, there was a lot of music going on. There was people making it work, and then there were shows in the squats, and there was also fucking a lot of cool spaces in the neighborhood back then.
Right.
Really, the gas station was one of them, like on Avenue B. I mean, you wouldn't recognize. There were like night and day difference from now. And in such a short time, it's become like a mall there. Right. But it used to be dangerous and exciting. And there used to be a lot of like free open spaces that people cultivated and created gardens, community gardens everywhere, or like sculpture gardens. I mean, a lot of art flourished back then. There was spaces. ABC Norio was like kind of like the punk venue, but there was, and the Souls played there. We played there with Rancid on their first time out east, wow. Actually, and it was a smelly little fucking basement,
yeah.
With a kind of a community space where people exchange ideas and zines are being sold, and it was a whole thing. It was a lot of people doing a lot of positive shit. It was good to be around, and I had a lot of pride in myself during those years. Yeah, cause sure. I lived my thing was I was living within my own means, right? This is what I can afford. and I'm not asking for any handouts from anybody. This is, you know, and I have I'm directly building the space I'm living in, and directly, it was very like super simple, you know, mm-hmm. living out of like a backpack and a couple of, you know what I mean? You kind of, I mean, these are young kid phases. I guess I went through too, where I was like, I'm a renunciant. It's spiritual. It was like a quote. I said it then half joking, because I was living like, I'm like, I don't need anything, you know?
Like, right. Like a minimalist kind of thing.
Whatever.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. It's like, now, there's all these like really, as you explained, I mean, I think a lot of people have this misconception that the people involved with those situations are in it for, you know, like you said, like getting wasted, having no responsibility, blah, 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 like fuck the world kind of thing. And so mm-hmm. often, especially, you know, I've seen it more in Europe myself, but like, you know, when you get this collection of really useful and utilitarian people who are deciding to live a different way, it can be really inspiring. And what do you think, you know, what was the intention? Because, you know, you guys are putting yourselves in a very uncomfortable situation, a hard situation, something that demands like a lot of work and effort. What, if anything, do you think you were like collectively or individually trying to accomplish?
That's a really good question. First part of what you said is I couldn't agree more that you've been to Europe. You've seen like the squat thing, really the best example of the squat thing there, yeah. Where it's exactly that. It's the opposite of people that are in fuck ups. You know, these are people that are just creating their own life, and mm-hmm. it's harder and you give some shit up, but they are successfully living an alternate lifestyle. And yeah. It's pretty cool. What was the intention? For us, we never sort of blinked, and we were all focused on the same point forward and never blinking. Like, and everything was secondary to the band progressing. And we didn't even have we never defined what that progression was. It was always just the next thing, like the next level, like leveling up. Like just beyond, like what's the next, like let's keep working, like, and see, like if we fill out all these mailing cards, like maybe more people will come to the show. Like right. If we mail all these mailing cards, more people will come to the show. And so there was always that thing in kind of carrot on a stick where you're like working towards building something. And it was ambiguous. Is that the right word for that? It was just yeah. sort of undefined.
Sure.
We I think that the thing that the real fuel in our tanks was just being on this adventure together and avoiding doing what we knew we didn't want to do. So we never really knew, we never had a sharp definition of what we wanted, right. But we knew what we didn't want.
Sure.
And that's it sounds so simple, but that's all it was. We're like every day that we got away with hanging out, you know,
right.
And having right. fun and making music our life was a victory.
Yeah.
And I still have that attitude today. You know, if it all ended today, I would be happy because I got away with it for 30 years. I'm still like hanging out with my best fucking friends. Like yeah, that's, yeah. That was my priority in high school, I guess. Like not my only priority, but it was something that I wasn't willing to give up and neither were those, you know, and I think about this sometimes and we've never talked about it really, Pete and Greg and I, but none of us have brothers. And so we kind of filled that role in each other's lives. Like we are as brothers can be now, you know?
Yeah. You guys are so close. It's so cool to see.
Growing up, the fighting, the compromising, the learning, you know, each other, giving each other space and why, and you learn everything. And now we're just like, we're just brothers. Like, you don't have, nothing needs to be said, you know, like how that is with family. Like,
yeah.
It's so like, I'm so blessed to have that. I'm so grateful.
Yeah. It's awesome, man. You guys are such a tight knit unit and also taught me how to do tour laundry. which is something that I believe it was you outside of a bus who taught me how to do tour laundry. And I'm like, oh my God, this just changed my life. Well, yo, Brian, thanks for giving us all that time, man. That was fun.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. Well, yo, thanks, Brian. Good luck with everything and the family. And you're one of the best. And I appreciate you. I really do.
Thanks. Thanks so much for your time, you guys. I really had fun.
Thanks, dude.
All right. See you, Brian.
All right. That was good.
I feel inspired.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
I just feel nostalgic.
I feel nostalgic. I also feel like a little bit of a sellout because the people he's talking about, these people keep it so fucking real, you know? And I've made some steps that make me not keep it as real as that. So it makes me feel bad because they keep it so real, you know?
It's funny. Speaking of keeping it real, like the thing, you know, like, so we took the Souls on tour as an opening act.
Is that right?
Yeah, this is a really, it's kind of a depressing. This is 1996. I think it was Maniacal Laughter for them. And like, we had just released an album on Warner Brothers. And I mean, it was fucking so great to tour with those guys. I mean, and I really liked that record. And I love the band. And they were fun to tour with. But it was like, it was literally the decline of my band. Because we had signed to this, and this is not an anti-major label rant. This fucking major this label loved us. They threw tons of money at us. They fucking did everything they could. It was totally our fault that we imploded. But like, the one thing that did happen was that they sold us this bill of goods that like, we're going to go on this tour. We're going to get a radio, you know, we're going to start getting radio play. And these big venues that they'd booked us at were going to be full. And what happened was half the shows, the Souls outdrew us. Like, it was obvious that like more people were there to see them than us. They sold more merch. Half the shows were our shows where we were getting like spotty radio, but it was like a real testament to like, they were the fucking hard workers that had just done it DIY punk rock. And we were this band. I mean, we'd been around for 4 years at that point, but you know, we had chosen to go the major label route and like, it didn't work on the first record, and the label was ready to give us another record, but we didn't do it. We didn't stick around.
Right.
But it was a great tour, and like, it was just hilarious that they, you know, here we are, like, they're outselling us on merch. Even on the nights that were kind of our nights, they just had cooler merch.
Right. Yeah, they got the logo. They've had, like, the logo from the day great one, logo. Which is, I remember, which is huge.
On that tour, they had these awesome like work shirts that they had just like spray painted, or maybe they actually silk screened their logo and artwork on, and like, it was so brilliant because they had bought them by the pound.
Right. Yeah. It was, but I mean, so that's good. That's like the testament. That's, to me, is the Bouncing Souls. Like, they've been doing it from day one in this really like organic, internal, creative way where they've really never had to answer to too many people. Yeah. You know, I know they've made their jumps at times, they've had their wrinkles at times, but even it's a testament now. You know, they put out, you know, this new record.
Well, I mean, they did the equivalent right after that. They went to Epitaph and it didn't really work for them, right?
Right.
And, but they're still around, and it really warms my heart that they are, that they actually didn't let it get to their heads the way it did us, you know, and here they are.
And they just kept it. They kept it so creative, you know, like they're always constantly doing these things. I mean, they released an album song by song digitally, which like no one was doing yet. Right. And they did it,
right.
You know, like they even now, you know, are like self-releasing and putting these things out and having these connections with their fans and a relationship with their fans that's so close. And they also, you know, I think I mentioned it in the Pete one, is that they're all such uniquely creative people individually that they've been able to all manage their lives really well outside of the Bouncing Souls. And right. I think that's a big testament and something younger bands should take, is like, if you're going to start relying on your band as your primary source of everything in your life, then your band is going to be tied to some things eventually that you might not want it to. you know? And if you can manage to have a thing and not say not make any money, but, you know, not make sure like your kid's applesauce is always getting bought from this money. Like, it gives you a lot of freedom to do what you want, to pace yourself, to take right. this much time if you want it, this much time if you need it, release things differently. So the fact that, you know, Brian became a really successful tattoo artist and Pete records music and Greg writes records and books and does his own thing. And like, they've always had these fiercely independent and creative personalities that I think.
Well, you have to, to survive. As like Brian says, we're brothers, you know, like, and you can't all, yeah, you got to have separate lives if you're going to love your brother.
Yeah. And that thing that happened to you, that's just, that happens in anything semi-competitive, like, you know, like a movie where the co-star is like, oh, the co-star, or like, you know, or like the up and coming team, you weren't expecting to beat the old team. And you're like, well, here they are. They're on the map now.
Right.
I've been that band and I've taken that band.
Right.
Like, I've been the band that's ruined a headlining band's tour. And I've had it ruined by other ones, you know, like, but I like that shit because there are a lot of bands who won't take challenging bands as openers.
Right.
Well, you know, they won't take a great band as an opener because they're a little concerned. And I guess I can understand it from a certain mentality. But I really believe in like the rising tide brings everybody up. You know what I mean?
And you want to see a great show before you go on.
Like, if you love music and you love good people playing music, you should be stoked that they're doing it. And you should make your show that much more exciting afterwards. You know, like it should improve the night.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing about headlining touring bands that pisses me off is like, you know, you get in, you're charging $30, $40 fucking dollars for your show. You're responsible for the night.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, if there's two shit bands before you, you chose them.
Exactly.
And you made someone pay fucking $20 to see them.
I agree.
You know, you're giving people an evening. Like book some good fucking bands.
And, you know, we actually, once we kind of saw that it was going that way, at least on a few nights where we knew that it was going to be their crowd, we asked if we could switch the bill. And like at that point, like our manager and even Stormy, God bless her, she's the greatest. But even Stormy was like, no, you can't do that. It just doesn't look right. And we didn't. But yeah, couldn't be punk rock anymore after that.
I think your pants were too tight, Brad.
They were definitely too tight for punk rock. Anyway, let's wrap it. But Brian, you can check out his Instagram and his beautiful fucking baby. So, I grew up with an adopted sister who, I got to say, this little baby really reminds me of her. But he's at Brian_Keenlin on Instagram and then Bouncing Souls NJ at Instagram and Twitter. Check it out. And of course, we've got our Patreon.
That's right.
.com/goingofftrack, which, if you'll help me do an intro, we can do some more fucking New Jersey bonus material for that show. That's supposed to be
the aforementioned Kate Hilt.
Yes. Which has a lot to do with tonight's podcast. So
very much so. And also check out Volume 2, which is
the record they
just released, which is you know, reworked classical Bouncing Souls songs, you know, into this new record, which is cool as hell.
Yeah.
And they're doing a lot of fun stuff with like their Patreon, being really interactive with fans. So support the Souls.
Hell yeah.
Any way you can.
One of the funnest, maybe the funnest punk rock band ever, really.
Yeah. If I dread the day there's no Bouncing Souls in my life. They were there when I started. You know, like some of the first shows I went to, I saw these young bands and, you know, in Elks Lodges covering Bouncing Souls songs. And then I started going to their shows. Then I eventually met them and toured with them and like became my peers. And now they're still it's just this mainstay in my life.
And they're super relevant. They're totally relevant. Yeah.
Always important. Yeah. So I dread the day that's not in my life anymore. Don't stop bouncing souls, please. Please. I can't take it. The world's too hard. I need some consistency, please.
I need some bouncing.
I need something steady. You're the only thing I have.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for supporting us. And we'll see you all next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.